we're working towards this feeling of burnout for parents. I think it's building and building. And as a site, it's always been our mission at parents.com to be help to parents, to just be that sort of whisper in the ear, that secret recipe, that secret sauce to help you feel just a little bit more in control as a parent.
Welcome back to Media Voices. We're the Media Focus podcast that takes a look at all the news and views from the media world this week. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
And that quote you just heard was from Julia Dennison, who's the executive editor of Meredith's parenting brand, Parents.com. We talked about how they're supporting parents who are trying to juggle childcare and their own jobs during the pandemic, what they do to anticipate their audience's needs, how they tackle polarised topics for parents, and why they've launched a new podcast.
But ahead of that, we're going to launch into our news roundup. The Guardian has announced plans to cut 180 jobs. So it's in both editorial and commercial, 110 in departments like advertising, and 70 coming from editorial. That's because revenues are expected to be down by more than 25 million. They effectively said, we have a 25 million black hole, I think was the term they used. That is bad news for a paper that seemed to be doing really well.
Peter, why is this your lead story this week? Because this is what we were basically fighting about in the comments this morning.
Yeah, because it is deja vu. It's like, well, you know, deja vu all over again. It's more cuts. But I think the way The Guardian is approaching this is worth a conversation. You know, when it was first announced, it was they're cutting event staff, they're cutting advertising staff, they're cutting editorial staff. We had this story in the newsletter, and we said that we were a little bit, we were wondering about cutting editorial when their revenues are so focused these days on readers. Mm-hmm. But then an update that I've seen, Chris Williams, who's the Sunday Telegraph business editor, had an update on Twitter. It's the Saturday edition that's going to take the brunt of The Guardian's editorial cuts. So mm-hmm. The Guide, The Weekend Review, travel print sections, they're all going. I just, you know, to me that's, I don't know.
You think it's self-defeating?
Yeah, a little bit, I wonder. Well, because the Saturday circulation is twice the weekday circulation. Mm-hmm. Now, that only tells part of the story. The Saturday paper costs way more to produce than the weekday paper. So, yeah, if you're looking at, you know, cost cutting, which they have to, then, yeah, that makes sense. But if there's so many people engaging with The Guardian in print on a Saturday, I wonder if the cuts to the Saturday edition and the cuts to the lifestyle aspect of this are maybe going to come back and bite them in the ass.
Well, don't forget that. I mean, this isn't the only closure of what you'd think of as kind of lifestyle non-news content, because they also closed Guardian Soulmates. I don't know whether it's just they don't see that delivering the ROI that the news content does, or whether this is, as you mentioned, more of a cost thing. Maybe even an experiment to see if they can just ditch print entirely.
Presumably they've got all the data to show where their reader revenue and their contributions comes from, so they'll essentially use that to cut down areas that don't.
No, I don't think that's what's driving this. It's absolutely cost. They're looking at the Saturday edition. You know, any weekend edition is bigger and brighter and more expensive to produce.
Ton of supplements.
Yeah, and they're just thinking, we can save money here. But, you know, a bunch of German papers ages ago did the exact opposite of this. Mm. They canned their weekly print editions and went with a weekend edition.
This would have been years ago now. I remember reading an article basically saying the model for print newspapers now is to ditch daily and go weekly and make it a premium, you know, effectively a magazine-like experience.
Yeah, weekend print has that can have that kind of magazine style.
You know, lean you buy it. Experience.
Oh yeah. My god!
You buy it on a Saturday, but you
truly
read it all
deja
week.
Vu. That it's just such a shame, because they were those last 3 years they'd really defied expectations. They'd proved the doubters wrong in terms of, you know, actually managing to break even. Admittedly, they did it by a very aggressive series of cuts, you know, previously. And for this to have come in and just more people losing their jobs as a result, it's just heartbreaking.
Yep. Absolutely. And you know, they've still got the Observer, so it's not like they're not there on the newsstands at the weekend. Again, all the numpties were out. Oh, we hate The Guardian. They took against Corbyn. We're glad they're shutting down. Piss off, you
Yeah, exactly. That's completely ridiculous.
Get it up,
yeah. Okay, well, moving on then to, I suppose, a more experimental topic. Pink News is pivoting to paid. So I think, is it the world's largest LGBTQ plus publisher? So they are launching a membership scheme to help reduce its reliance on ad revenue. Given that ad budgets in the UK have been slashed to their lowest ever level, according to the IPA, widespread pessimism about ad budgets in the back half of 2020, this seems smart to me, particularly in light of all the other memberships that we've seen doing quite well over the last couple of years. So Esther, what is Pink News offering as part of its membership?
So £50 a year gets members early access emails, a quote, ad light experience, which I will remain sceptical about. You get invites to webinars, video meetings with the Pink News editorial team. It's a real kind of really nice membership package they've got going here. And I think that it's... Oh, and you get 10% off in the Pink News shop, where I think you could buy sunglasses and badges and things like that now. Yeah, and I think they're also looking later in the year to do exclusive news analysis and sort of reader-only comments, which, I mean, they've got a really strong, really defined community, and I think this is a very, very smart move for them.
Why do you think they have effectively set this out as a future roadmap for that exclusive content rather than making that the central tenet of its move to paid?
Honestly, I just said that's probably a timing thing at the moment. If they need to invest in people, in editors to get that content, like, we're in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah. In the same way that, who was it? It wasn't Gal Dem, was it? Who had their hand forced almost and they had to... Was it Gal Dem?
Yeah.
And they launched their membership ahead of time almost.
Well, I mean, again, I don't think... It'll be one of the things where I think because of who they're aimed at, I can imagine people aren't going to be there like, oh, I'm not going to sign up until the exclusive content's available. Mm. They'll sign up to support the site anyway because of... The content they provide and because of the community they provide for those people. So
why are you sceptical of the ad light format?
I can remember reading some research a couple of years ago that was basically just like, nobody gives a toss about ad light.
it's also, what does ad light mean versus ad free?
Yeah.
Do they mean tracker light in the same way that, you know, actually, it's a site experience sort of thing. It's a UX thing. And having ads constantly pop up is interruptive, but it also slows the page speed down.
Put it this way. If I was really bothered about ad light, I'd install an ad blocker.
Also on the membership agenda, Cosmo US is introducing a paid membership program. So, Peter, what is Cosmo offering?
For $2 a month, readers get unlimited access to website content. They get bonus stories exclusives. They get members-only email. If they pay $20 up front, they also get an annual subscription to the print magazine. So they'll get merch deals, they'll get discounts, early access to events. I'm so skeptical about this one. This is a classic. Membership is not a silver bullet. Esther said it 2 minutes ago about Pink News. Pink News has put together a really nice package. You know, you've got, forgetting the ad light experience, you've got these webinars and the video meetings of Pink News people and also high profile members of the LGBT community. What's going on with Cosmo? It's like you're just getting what you got before, except now you can't have any more than 4 stories if you don't pay.
I'm going to try and be careful not to like sneer at this too much, but I find... So, I'm not going to say I remember the old Cosmopolitan because I'm not old enough to remember what Cosmopolitan used to be, but it was very much from what I've read. It used to be like a bit like Stylist is today in the UK. Like it was for urban women. It was very smart. It was very feminist forward. And this I'm reading this from their website. This is how they currently describe their magazine. It's like pulling off the trend that's all over your feed, being the best party throw your friends know. Also, yes, there's sex and astrology, lots of astrology. And it's like, that's not selling it to smart women. Like, who is their demographic? You know, ever since these sort of digital sites have come up, you've got sites like Refinery29, you've got all these really smart sites that are appealing to women, and they're just a bit more of a niche. I just think, what has Cosmopolitan got that's unique anymore?
Which paper is it that has a dedicated astrology app? I think it might be the NYT, has a paid astrology app.
Vice has a paid
astrology. You're right. Yeah, sorry, it's not the only thing. It's Vice. Yeah, so Vice has that paid one.
If you're really into astrology, you will pay for it. But
well,
that's a niche.
Their target audience is like young women, and you just, that is not a target audience anymore. You can't build up a community around gender because people are so different. And you know, this is where I think these two stories are interesting this week, because you've got the Pink News who know exactly who their audience is, and you've got Cosmo who just don't.
I think more than that as well, it's this idea that, I mean, Peter, was it you who put in the membership SmackDown idea yes. here?
Let's get ready to rumble!
But the problem is that we all agree.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, if you take Pink News versus Cosmo, who's going to win that one?
Well, that's a different question. I think Pink News' one is better because they have that mission, they have that clearly defined community, as you both said. But do they have the resource and the scalability that Cosmo potentially does for this?
I think so, yeah. I think they've got a very well-defined community. They've, you know, we had Ellen Stewart on talking about the engagement that they had from the community through social media. They'll push this really hard. I think they'll do well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they will as well. The one thing I would say about the reason I think Cosmo will do well, at least initially, is that the subscription is dirt cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Like $20 a year for like all of the stuff in and a print magazine through your door. But then that works the other way, because then people aren't going to value it because it's cheap. So onto the news in brief. It would have been impossible to miss Twitter's cataclysmically bad week this week. Hackers basically hijacked prominent accounts to promote a cryptocurrency scam, which people were stupid enough to fall for.
You know, people buy into celebrity. If Elon Musk is like, hey, buy my Bitcoin, he has a legion of fanboys who'll go, yeah.
It was send me $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, I'll send you $2,000 back. Like, come on.
Yeah, anyway, I've got a bridge to sell you.
Yeah, one of the things we learned this week is that people are stupid. So
you learn that every week.
Okay, fair play. So accounts like Barack Obama, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, and Apple's official account were all hacked. And within minutes, it all sent out these tweets with details of this Bitcoin wallet you were supposed to send stuff to. Twitter like promptly disabled everything, and they just said anybody with a verified account can't tweet.
You know, that once they're in, they have access to DMs. And is it likely that we're going to see reputational damage or, you know, insider information leaked further down the road?
Because Twitter did say that they downloaded the whole Twitter account details for 8 users, but they weren't verified users. So we know they've not downloaded like Trump's DMs or anything, as hilarious as that would be. And I think Twitter's still restricting logins for a number of people that were compromised this week. So, yeah.
Watch this space for more social fuck-ups.
News Corp is preparing to launch more than a dozen new digital-only titles in Australia.
Hey, I said no accents.
I wasn't an accent. That was an audio glitch. In major regional centres, Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia, they're hiring local journalists. What a concept. looking to launch the first 15 of up to 50 new titles by the end of September. That's an interesting one, that kind of switch to digital only region.
Yeah.
John, I actually think if you're it's easier to launch these titles without the whole legacy stuff behind you. I think the people that struggled are the people that, you know, the regional papers that have had legacy, that have had these huge organisations behind them. If you can be quite nimble and just launch new digital sites, I think there's a bit of legroom in this. And actually, it's nice to read this from Australia as well, because I feel like
the news from Australia the last two months has just
been terrible.
Definitely. I wonder how they're going to... But if it is like a new digital title, I wonder how they're actually going to promote that, particularly in sort of the sparsely populated regions in Victoria. You know, that's going to be an interesting one.
And the fact that we have actually been pretty nice about News Corp here is amazing. So, yay! Well,
yeah. News Corp, that's a funny name. I would have called it. Yes, what's that?
Apple News has got a big update this week. You've now got the option to listen to premium Apple News Plus audio stories if you're a News Plus subscriber. Is anybody out there that's actually a News Plus subscriber?
Is anybody out there asked to listen to audio news stories?
Well, wasn't it?
Well, we've got a story following this.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
There's also now a local news section where, again, they're just scouting off publishers that are already writing the local news. And there's a daily recap podcast that is available to everyone, which has actually caused a little bit of outrage on Twitter this week. Of people saying Apple do not need to launch a podcast, basically scabbing off other people's work.
Yeah. You know, isn't that the point with this? Apple has cash reserves bigger than many countries,
mm-hmm.
and they still won't spend money on content. You know, it's just, you know, Netflix is spending money on content, Spotify is spending money on content. What is wrong with Apple? I use Apple products, but Jesus wept.
Hey, speaking of spending on podcasts, we haven't mentioned Michelle Obama.
There's questions about whether all this stuff Spotify is doing is actually technically a podcast.
Oh, it's not a podcast. No, that's the thing. It's definitely not a podcast.
Spotify's signed, I think it's an exclusive deal with Michelle Obama, isn't it?
A show. A show. To be fair, I think that row has been a bit of a distraction from the fact that Spotify is spending so readily on audio content.
Oh my God, this isn't a podcast. I'm not getting it through my RSS feed.
Yeah. And in fact, for something like that, you know, and all the stuff, the number of comic book series they've signed over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah,
people,
I saw some
people
of that.
Will be buying Spotify subscriptions just to get access to those audio shows.
Well, that's exactly it. And if you're listening to stuff on Spotify, even if it's not technically a podcast, that is, they are a huge competitor now in the audio space. Oh, and finally, the Washington Post has also launched audio versions of all its articles, Peter, so people might well listen to Daily News.
God. Audio version of all its articles. The Guardian long form, I think, is one of the best podcasts in the world. Point being, they choose the long form articles that they're going to put in that podcast. All articles in audio? I can't imagine ever doing that.
Okay, I mean, nor could they. So they ran this test, and they said that they were first expecting people to, like, just use it on their commute. But apparently people have basically been getting up in the morning, making their coffee, or it would be coffee in America, wouldn't it? and they've basically just been playing the articles in the morning. They've actually been really surprised to see, and I quote, sort of steady adoption and use as people continue to work from home.
So what's the audio? Is it, like, automated reads, or is it human reads, or...?
No, it's text-to-speech capabilities built into the Android and iOS operating
systems. It's also
going to
be awful.
Well, Peter, the Media Voices audience hasn't figured out that we're text-to-speech yet.
The Scottish accent is actually one of the most advanced, one of the most advanced AI programs on the planet.
So this week I spoke with Julia Dennison, who is the executive editor at Parents.com. I started off by asking her what her role as executive editor normally involves when there's not a global pandemic on.
My role as executive editor is just basically overseeing all the editorial content that goes on the website, so on Parents.com, and all the related social media platforms. And we're on all of them, whether it's Instagram or Facebook. We have a Facebook group. We're even on TikTok now, as long as President Trump allows us to be. But yeah.
Are parents on TikTok?
You know what? You would be so surprised. There is a huge demographic of millennial moms on TikTok just being really real. And I think it's actually a platform that appeals to parents. And it's my favorite right now because it's so honest and there's like no filter. There's just talking about what it really is to be a parent these days, which is very much in line with what we try to do with parents. So.
And at the moment, obviously, huge numbers of parents, yourself included, are having to be kind of both full-time workers and full-time parents. So as a parenting site, what are you doing to kind of help address this with your audience?
Sure. So it's really asking the impossible of parents, and it still is. You know, we're talking now months into this pandemic, and schools have been shut, and now summer camps are closed, and it's not even looking like schools are going to fully open in the fall. And it's not like this gets any easier for parents. I always say there's plenty of studies to point to the fact that we aren't, as humans, can't really multitask. You really can't do two things at once. And this pandemic has been asking parents to do that very thing. Working parents, work full time and watch your kid full time without help and without your extended village and without all the resources that you normally can lean on as a parent. So as a site, as parents.com, it's never been more important for us to be there for parents as a resource. And we've really tried to do that very thing. And we're all living it. I mean, I am a mother of a four-year-old, and I co-parent with her dad. So when I have Esme, my daughter, it's 100% on, and I have to take those Zoom calls, and I have to do my meetings, and I have to do my work while also looking after my daughter. And it's still the case now here as I speak to you in July. And, you know, if schools are only going to go partly back in the fall, then it's going to be the case for a long time in the foreseeable. And it's been so, so stressful. And that's what we're hearing from our audience. Just this, like, we're working towards this burnout, this feeling of burnout for parents. I think it's building and building. And as a site, it's always been our mission at parents.com to be help to parents, to just be that sort of whisper in the ear, that secret recipe, that secret sauce to help you feel just a little bit more in control as a parent. So through the pandemic, we've obviously been there with informative resources on the disease itself. So from the very beginning, when it first started, we had a guide to what parents should expect from COVID and the coronavirus, and how to protect your kids and how to get kids to wear masks and all that sort of nitty gritty. And then it kind of transitioned into just parents realizing how hard this was and needing to hear that they weren't alone. So we make sure we publish plenty of content to reassure them and to show them that we're all in this. So first person essays, you know, reassuring pieces like you really don't need to formally homeschool your kids
yet
to keep them learning throughout school closures. You know, just be easy on yourself. We're all in this together. And then once that kind of phase of just like, holy cow, this is super stressful for parents, was sort of really hit home throughout April into May, all of a sudden parents were like, okay, shoot, we need resources to actually support our kids through this. So that, and when I say support, I mean give them things to do that isn't just the iPad or the TV, so that parents can actually get work done. So we started seeing an uptick in traffic to our entertaining and fun pages. So whether that was crafts, you know, we had tie-dye crafts started trending, or going into the summertime, we did a piece, a roundup of virtual summer camps, and that started to pick up in traffic. And, you know, all these things that we thought weren't exactly core parenting topics before, they were the nice-to-haves, you know, like how to set up a backyard movie night. These were things that was like, oh, okay, if you have the extra time to be that parent, great, go for it. But, you know, it was the icing on the cake. Well, now it is core parenting, right? Because parents are suddenly like, shoot, I really need this entertainment, these fun resources, and this ability to entertain my kids. Not because I'm trying to be a great parent. Yes, I'm trying to be a great parent, obviously. But also I'm trying to take this Zoom call right now. And what can I hand over to my kid that will keep them entertained? So we've really just tried to be there in all respects for parents. And then now as things start to open up again, it's a whole new raft of content that's becoming interesting for parents. And it's that question of, when is it safe to send my kid to daycare? When is it safe to have a play date? What do play dates look like during the pandemic or right after as social distancing eases? What will school look like in the fall? What are the worries? If school opens, should I even send my kid back to school if there's no vaccine? All these myriad of questions that are going through parents' heads. We are a site that is predominantly based on search traffic. So people are coming in through Google. So we always want to make sure that we're answering every single question that any parent would ever have, ever. So that means now more than ever, because parents have so many questions and there aren't a lot of answers, but we are just constantly updating our content with whatever we do know and just whatever we can do to support parents.
So do you set the editorial strategy around what search traffic comes in, or are you being at all proactive in sort of guessing what people might be wanting in the next couple of months?
Right. So it's a mix because things have been changing so much. We keep a really close eye on Google search trends to make sure that we're answering any trend that's related to our audience and our beat and parents. We want to make sure that we're answering those questions. So we're looking at Google trends. We're formulating our content based on what we know people are starting to search and what searches are taking off. We're also just looking at what content is doing well for us on search and making sure that we are building out as much content around there as possible. So if we're seeing those, like, you know, tie-dye crafts, for example, if we're seeing that kind of take off, then we're going to make sure that we've got all the tie-dye crafts covered. you know, so we look at our own search trends to see what's happening and what people are coming through to parents.com for. We're also looking at Google trends. And then, you know, a lot of us are parents and we're living this life, right? So I've just been using this as a great opportunity. Is every time I scratch my head about, you know, wondering how the heck I'm going to make this work, I think, okay, is there content on parents that answers that question? So it's a sort of a three-pronged approach there.
Yeah. And pre-pandemic, was that a similar approach that you just kind of kept an eye on what parents were interested in, you know, that season or that month?
Yeah, of course. We're actually not that seasonal of a site, because so much of parenting is just really just this, you know, the core parenting questions are questions you're going to be asking no matter what the time of year. And obviously we would make sure that we have content around all the different seasons and how that would affect parenting, whether it's allergies or, you know, the stress of the holidays. But for the most part, our content tends to focus a lot around early days of parenthood. So, you know, when you're pregnant and you're a first-time parent, that tends to be when you have the most questions. So a lot of our search traffic will be around that first year with baby or during pregnancy when people are doing it all for the first time and just wondering how the heck they do it, this crazy parenthood journey. And so, yes, search has always been a priority for us. And because we're a trusted source and people, and we're an old brand and people recognize us, we are the kind of brand that someone is going to see in the search results and think, okay, well, I'll click on that because I know who, I know parents and I trust what they have to say.
Yeah. And I know a lot of the discourse, sort of, especially in the US, is around the pandemic has been really, really polarized and politicized. So how do you approach that as an editorial team when your audience might have quite strong, like, divergent views on it?
I know, it's really hard. I mean, I've always tried to be on the right side of history, whether it's something to do with science or whether it's something to do with what's happening in society. It's the same thing with the anti-vaxxer debate. You know, in the world of parenting, we do get plenty of people commenting who might consider themselves anti-vaxxers. We don't give airtime to right. anti-vaxxers. We are always ensuring that we are a scientifically backed health site so that all of the content on our site is correct as far as science goes. And that's what we always maintain. And I think that this debate around the pandemic, we just still kind of, you know, lean on the side of science, but also be sympathetic and explain things in a clear way, in a way that we think people will want to share. So we just did one yesterday, a story yesterday based on a social trend on Facebook where moms were kind of, you know, getting very irritated about the whole mask debate of whether or not you should wear a mask. And our story was moms clap back on mask debate. If we can wear masks during labor, you can wear them shopping. So it's, you know, it's like... of course, there's always going to be other opinions on our site, but those are opinions. And we, at the end of the day, we are a research-backed website that publishes scientifically backed content, and that's what we'll always maintain, and that's what we'll always do. I think you have to do it in a way that's not alienating. So we would never shame anybody for thinking something, but we would just continue to tell the true story. And produce the facts and let the facts speak for themselves, right? That's what we always try to do.
I noticed you've got a diversity of families section on the website. Is that a recent feature in response to the Black Lives Matter protest?
You know, we've always prioritized the diversity of families on parents.com. It's always been something that we've felt was important, hence why we've actually just launched in June, and I'll talk about this more. The podcast, We Are Family, is all about celebrating the beautiful diversity of families today. But that was based on an editorial series that I did 2 years ago, I think is when we originally launched it, all around celebrating the diversity of families today. And we know, because we're such a nationally recognized and internationally recognized parenting brand, we know that whatever we represent as family is, you know, what people will take as what family is in the world we live in. So we try to present as many different images of family and what family looks like as we possibly can. And absolutely, as far as Black Lives Matter, this is a very important cause to us and something that we've been behind for a long time. Back in April, actually, we did a spotlight feature, or it was a sort of a editorial package of content around maternal mortality in America. And we spoke a lot as part of that on how Black mothers and mothers of color were disproportionately affected by maternal mortality in America and by problematic birth rates. And just the very fact that they were bearing the brunt of it. So that was something we actually got a Black editor to come in and edit that spotlight for us. And we did a lot of pieces on Black women who were dying unnecessarily in childbirth and through preventable things that were absolutely preventable, and really shined a light on it. As part of that, we'd already taken steps to, for example, as an editorial style guide, to capitalize the B in Black. That is something that our writers had requested of us, and it's something that was easy enough for us to make a change in the style guide. So that's something you're seeing a lot of other publications changing now during the Black Lives Matter movement, recently in the last month or two, but it's something that we'd already done. But, you know, I also understand that I'm white, and so much about publishing is built on those who look like me, and people who look like me benefit from systemic racism. And so I think that's a lot about, if you're a white person in publishing, it's so important to step up and try to make the changes that you can and make room and lift Black writers and lift Black voices and tell Black stories. And that's been a huge priority of mine, and it's now more than ever. And I'm making a very conscious effort to ensure that we are using at least 40% of our writers Black, writers of color, and also our sources. But more than that, you know, we have to overcompensate for a long history of whitewashing that's happened in publishing. And I'm very aware of that. And as far as our content, this is sort of related to what I was just talking about when you're dealing with these divisive topics. We found that actually our content we've been publishing related to Black Lives Matter has been doing very well. But what does best are these explainers. So we did an explainer on how to explain Juneteenth, the holiday, to your kids. That did really well. Our top story around this topic was Six Reasons All Lives Matter Doesn't Work in Terms Simple Enough for a Child. And that just blew up and got tons of traffic and tons of shares, and people were really responding to it. And I think it's the one thing I noticed through all this is we didn't lose hardly any Instagram followers when other brands out there in the world, when they made a statement on how they felt about Black Lives Matter and how important it was to support Black lives and Black voices and tell Black stories. You did see some brands losing Instagram followers just because of how politically rife it can get. Well, we did not. And I think that's testament to the fact that we've already been covering these topics so much. So if you were going to drop out, which, you know, it's like, good riddance, we don't need you. But, you know, if you were going to drop out because you didn't like what you saw at Parents, you would have done it already. So I thought that was really kind of interesting to see. But we do still get some, you know, pushback and comments. We have a great piece on how to be anti-racist as a family. And we posted it to Instagram, and we had something about checking your white privilege. And well, we got a ton of flack in the comments about white privilege, and, you know, how could we say that? And you know, it just, to me, that just said, okay, we need to step back and we need to do another explainer piece on what it means when we're talking about white privilege, and explain this to our audience in a way that's not, and that hopefully will convince at least a few people in favor of understanding and recognizing their white privilege and what that means. So small steps, and I think you just keep doing it. And I just think if you can convince anybody, that's a win.
So tell me about the podcast. Why did you decide to launch a podcast in a pandemic?
I know. Well, we'd already had it planned, and it was funny because we have podcasting recording studios at Meredith, and my co-host, Sean T, who's the founder of the Insanity Workout, and he's got this massive following himself. He was on the cover of Parents magazine back in 2019. And he, with his husband and their two twin boys who they had through surrogacy. And he's just such an uplifting person and such an awesome human being. And I'd already had this editorial series called We Are Family, which was highlighting just the beautiful diversity of families today and how people become families today. I remember seeing a statistic that said that there were going to be more non-nuclear, quote unquote, non-traditional families than 2.5 nuclear household families as soon as 2020. So there is just a huge diversity of what it means to be a family in America today. And I thought it was really important for us to tell those stories and show those different families. And when I was thinking of co-hosts, because Sean T is such a beautiful, amazing family as a Black dad, as a gay Black dad, and with his husband, and their cover got such an, speaking of content that we were already out there in the forefront at Parents, We got pushback on the cover because, you know, haters are going to hate, but we got so much more celebration of that cover because it was the first gay dads on the cover. And everyone was just, you know, we're just so happy to see it. And his story is so uplifting that I thought he would make a really great co-host with his story. And then my own story, I'm divorced. I co-parent, as I mentioned before, with my daughter's dad. And so, I just felt like looking at Instagram, I didn't always see my family setup reflected back at me. I found myself looking at social media and thinking, oh, like feeling guilty, feeling bad. Like, why don't I have this beautiful nuclear family with, you know, everybody in matching outfits on the beach together in harmony is what I'm seeing on Instagram. Of course, the truth is that's what you're seeing on Instagram, and who knows what's actually happening behind that. But I realized there wasn't enough portrayals of different kinds of families out there. And you know, the more you just represent family as family and love as love, and, you know, not trying to say anything revolutionary, not trying to say like, look at this like crazy unique family. It's just, this is another kind of family. This is another way of loving. This is another way of people become a family. And the more you tell those stories and the more you show them, the better. So we had this opportunity to do a podcast, and it felt like podcasting was a really great platform to tell those stories, just to get those voices in there. And the idea was we were going to fly Sean from Arizona to come to New York to do these recording sessions. And of course, then the pandemic hit, and we just, you know, had to keep going with it. And we just decided we were going to continue as planned and record from our respective closets. And so, you know, even though I can't be in the same room with Sean, he's always texting me. I always text him. We're always, you know, we're very good friends from afar. So we're about as best of co-hosts as could possibly be, you know, bar just the fact that we're not able to meet up for margaritas from time to time, which, you know, one day we'll get there. We'll get there. So, yeah.
And I know a while back you started documenting your own experience as a daily video blog on YouTube. I think that's finished now, but how did that go?
Yeah, that went really well. I mean, it was, I just felt that, and it was funny because it started because I'd come back from Europe. And so I'd been quarantined for 14 days. Of course, when this was back in March, and I was like, I'm going to be all by myself and nobody else is going to be quarantining. Well, of course, that wasn't true. Everybody else was in the same boat as me and everyone had to quarantine. So I wasn't special, but I did feel that feeling of just being, you know, by myself with my daughter and in my tiny apartment in Queens, also trying to work full time and, you know, run the editorial on this national website. And, you know, feeling like I couldn't let anything drop. I had to keep all my plates spinning all the time. It was feeling very overwhelming. And I thought to myself, well, the best thing I can do for my audience is to show them that they are not alone. You know, I might be the editor of parents.com, but I am finding this just as hard as they are. And I find parenting, especially through a pandemic, just as hard as they do. So I just decided to start documenting it and showing them that, you know, I was juggling it all. And I had the moments where I was just in tears. My daughter had those moments where she was in tears. I had moments where I was taking Zoom calls with my daughter literally sitting on my head, and those moments still happen as I am recording this in my closet right now and speaking to you. I can hear at the very back of my head that my daughter is screaming in some other room with her dad. So you know, and we talk about that as parents, and we talk about that, we call it the mental load, just the very idea that, like, no matter what you're doing as a parent, you always have those, you know, you might be working full time, but you always have those parenting things in the back of your head. And I think the pandemic just highlighted that. So I just took my own phone camera and started documenting it just to show everybody that I was going through it, and they, you know, just to make everyone feel a little less alone. And we got really great feedback. Everyone in the comments just were so grateful and thankful. And, you know, I got DMs from moms everywhere just saying, thank you. Thank you for just being so honest. And I decided I wouldn't hide anything, you know, and I would just talk about it. I, you know, had moments where I was like, I'm trying to make pancakes for my daughter and they're just getting, you know, burnt, and I'm also trying to slack at the same time, and I'm also, you know, and let's be real, my daughter's watching screens all day, because what else? I need to be able to work, you know, I need to be able to put food on the table. So I think that just the very fact that I wasn't doing anything revolutionary, I was just telling everybody what I was doing and, you know, sharing my stress. But everyone loved that, and I think people just appreciated that just, you know, even editors of parenting sites don't know what the heck they're doing when it comes to being a parent. You know, I always joke, I say, you can be an expert in parenting as a subject, which I think at this point I would venture to say that I'm at least getting there as the editor of parents.com, but you can't be an expert parent. Nobody is. We're all figuring this out together, and it can just be, there's a really good TikTok where it was like, parenting hacks. Oh, there are no hacks. There's no hacks to parenting. You just have to figure it all out. And it's true. And so as the more we can just show everybody what's really happening and not try to sugarcoat any of it, I think that helps everybody. And certainly that seems to be the response I got from that YouTube series. And then eventually I stopped doing it, partly because it was one extra plate to spin. Yeah, you know, it was a lot.
What's been your proudest moment as executive editor of parents.com so far?
You know, I was thinking about that. It's really hard to say one proud moment. I think every time that I get a comment from somebody where some content that we've done has made a difference, that is my proud moment. And that will just make my month. We did a video recently it was a black family who adopted a white child, and it talked about how much racism that they were experiencing as a family every day. And this mom has to carry around her adoption papers just to show that she's the mother of her own child. I mean, it's just like, it's just one piece of the larger puzzle that black people are confronted with in America today when it comes to racism. And the comments that we got about that were just so reassuring and so lovely. And we had one comment that said, every now and again, there's a story that makes us feel proud to be human and live in this world. And that is just, comments like that just make me go, okay, we're doing the right thing here. We are telling the right stories, and by, you know, choosing the right stories to tell and getting feedback like that, it just tells me that I'm doing the right thing. Even if sometimes you get, like I was talking about before on Instagram, you get people pushing back and saying, how dare you talk about white privilege? You know, my white child is perfectly fine. Don't you? And it can be so disheartening, and it can feel like you don't always have your whole audience on board, and that can kind of break your heart. Well, comments like that will just automatically reassure me and remind me that everything we're doing is the right thing to be doing. So yeah, every time I get comments like that.
And the last thing we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you read or watched or listened to that really affected you, if you've had any time?
Sure. No, I know, right? You know, I watched Disclosure on Netflix. I don't know if you've seen that yet, but it's a documentary. Yeah, it's a documentary that is a really eye-opening look at how transgender people are depicted on TV and in movies. And it's just really kind of a wake-up call to how we treat transgender people in media and how important it is to treat them respectfully and portray them appropriately. But thinking with my parents hat on, there was a really beautiful moment when Jen Richards, who is a transgender actress, she talks about a brief, fleeting moment in the documentary series I Am Kate. So Caitlyn Jenner's series just documenting her transition and her life as a transgender woman, where a father of a child who transitioned was talking about not just the importance of accepting his child as transgender, but celebrating his child's, what makes his child unique and what makes them this amazing unicorn. And just Jen Richards, the transgender actress, was saying how beautiful that was and how she wished she'd had her parents say the same thing to her, not just accept, but to say, this makes you not just like every other kid, but that much more amazing. The topic of supporting transgender children is something that's very important to parents. And I just thought that was a reminder, not just accepting your kids for being different, being unique, but actually celebrating them and how important that was.
So if you didn't know Twitter got hacked this week, it's unlikely that you know that we have a daily newsletter. Well, we do. We have a daily newsletter that goes out every morning, 7 o'clock. The top 4 stories that we think you need to read to make you better at your job as a media professional. And some of them are just fun. So go to the website, get signed up, get our daily newsletter.
While you're there, you can follow the link to our Ko-fi page. I need to find a way to say it that sounds like both your pronunciations. Where you can contribute to the ongoing running costs of Media Voices. So we've been blown away by the sheer scale of people's generosity to date, but we do have existing costs, and more than that, we want to continue to experiment. So please do visit the site, click on through to Ko-fi, and you know, give whatever change you can spare. And we love you all, thank you.
I promise not to buy any more Costas with it.
Oh yeah,
I've been shamed on Twitter this week.
Yeah, you were. What's wrong with Costa?
It's not proper coffee, apparently. So if people give us Ko-fi money, we're expected to spend it on proper coffee, not Costa. Yeah, if you go to our website at voices.media, we've got a ton of stuff on there. We've got all the news and analysis we write about, because we are competent and write sometimes. What else have we got on there? We've also got transcripts on there, transcripts of all our interviews, which generally go up the Wednesday after the interview goes out. Or if you want to follow along with all the stories we tweet on each week, you can follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod.
But until next week, when we will be back with a fantastic guest and another tour through all the media news and views that week, thank you so much for listening and stay safe.
And be kind.
Wear a mask.
Desperately trying to come up with a catchphrase.
Oh, I like to wear a mask. Oh, no, Esther, good one.